My intention today is to try to get us ready for the book of Philippians, which we are going to be studying in the next month. So today I'm going to talk about the background of the book of Philippians. I call it one small step for a few Christians, one giant step for the church. So we are going to go into Acts 16, and I will have my friend Tammy read as we go along. But let me tell you first just a little bit about where we are. Paul and Silas are on a second missionary journey, going back to strengthen the churches in Asia Minor that they started on the first trip. They're also giving the recommendations of the Jerusalem Council to all the churches about how Jews and Gentiles are to interact with each other, and what is to be required of Gentiles. It's pretty easygoing stuff, so they're being very well accepted by the churches, and it's really been an encouraging time. And they have been traveling in what is northwestern Turkey, in those days Asia Minor. I guess if you got the map there. So I think I've got this jobby here, as you can see. So they have been trying to go to Bithynia, but they don't get there. They keep being told by the Spirit, no, not Bithynia. Well, how about, Mysia? No, go around Mysia. So now they have finished going to all the churches that they know. There's no more churches. Now, I don't know about you, but you might have noticed this about missionaries. A lot of them are pioneers, and they don't know how to stop. They don't know how to go back home. They don't know how to go settle down and take, their RSPs out and enjoy themselves. They're always wanting to keep going. So you can sort of sense in this first chapter, chapter 16 at the beginning of Acts, that they are just trying to find what to do now. Now, I don't know about you, but when you stop work, you have to try to figure out, what do I do now? And so they end up going to Troas because they like to keep moving. And they go to Troas, which is, Troas is actually, it's right just between, you notice the little water here, that's Europe, this has been Asia. So there is the change, be going to Europe to Asia. And now the church is going to go to Europe. It's going to get eventually to Yarrow. It's going to get to Vancouver, and it's going to start with this trip. So they're going on a short trip. Now they don't know how whether they should go there or not, because we have found that they've been told not to go north or not to go east. They have then had, in Troas, they're sitting there talking, and they are Timothy, Silas, Paul, and now Luke. So there are at least four people. Luke is the author of the book of Acts, and he is a doctor. It's actually going to be fairly useful to have a doctor on this trip. In fact, I recommend most times when you go anywhere far away, take a doctor with you. I take a nurse. But you need to take somebody who's going to be of help to you. And the other thing, of course, is that it's really good that Luke is a doctor, because he's the one writing this book. And doctors are fairly good at noticing things. In fact, when my doctor sees me, he says, "What's that?" He looks at me and, "What's that? What's that?" And I've never noticed it. So it's good to have somebody who's good at noticing. And he is also going to be a witness to what has been said and seen. Because there's a long oral tradition in Israel that you tell stories. That's how you can tell people what happened. And it's really good if the guy who's writing it down is somebody who actually notices things and takes notes and is organized. And Luke is such a person. So the four of them are now going to go to Europe. So we start with this comment in verse 12 of Acts 16, and if you want, you can follow from Acts 16, starting at verse 12. You might want to do that. although it'll also be on the overhead. At Troas, Paul has a vision at night of a Macedonian calling him for help. So the team discuss it over breakfast, and they decide that this is the guidance they need. They're going to go to Europe. So they go, it says, they traveled to Philippi, a Roman colony and the leading city of that district of Macedonia, and they stay there several days. Now tell me what you notice about Philippi. In that one verse, what are you told? And by the way, I'm expecting you to interact. Sorry? It's a major city. Where in what Macedonia, which is part of Greece. Okay, so it's in Greece. What else is it? It's in Rome. So it's quite interesting. It's in Italy and it's in Greece. It's a Roman colony. Now, this is something you wouldn't know, but a Roman colony is a colony in which the emperor has given land to people who have served him. So this is actually a retirement center for the Italian army, for the Roman army. So this is a place where those who are have been faithful servants to Caesar for 30 years are now retired. Now, I don't know about you, but what do you think that's characteristic of this city? I mean, if you had a retirement center for the RCMP and you lived next door, what would it be like? What would it be like living next to cops who have memorized every law that the Canadian government has set? Yeah, they'll all be on the strata. Yeah, and they'll be making sure that everybody is doing things properly. So it's a Roman colony. It's a Greek city of great influence. It's actually on the Via Ignatia, the highway that goes from Europe to Asia. In fact, stones are still there in the places of northern, in the northern areas of Turkey, etc., where you can find the stones that they still walked on when they're going from Italy right through to Asia. It's a bit like Vancouver in a way, because there's also on the sea, so you have shipping, you have all people coming by boat, you have people coming both ways on highways, and you have people who speak Greek, people who speak Latin, people who speak all kinds of different languages. It's like Vancouver, except we don't have a lot of cops. And we've noticed, we're certainly not a lot of military. We don't have people marching around with guns all the time. So Luke gives us now seven scenes of what happens in Philippi. And I want you to think about whether you would, if you had gone through this, would you remember 15 years later some of these scenes? Which one would be the most memorable to you? So first of all, Tammy, would you read scene 1, starting at verse 13?
Scene 1. On the Sabbath, we went outside the city gate to the river, where we expected to find a place of prayer. We sat down and began to speak to the women who had gathered there. One of those listening was a woman named Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth from the city of Thyatira, who was a worshiper of God. The Lord opened her heart to respond to Paul's message. When she and the members of her household were baptized, she invited us to her home. "If you consider me a believer in the Lord," she said, "come and stay at my house." And she persuaded us.
Okay, what happens in this scene? What is meaningful to you in this scene? What do you notice? Just one thing each, so, you know, let's have a few sentences here. Sorry, a little louder. Yes, she responded this. Well, let's put it this way. Tell me about Lydia. Tell me about this lady. Who responds? She was a prominent person in society. She's wealthy. She is actually the representative of a manufacturing company in where? She's from? Thyatira, right? Now, isn't this interesting? We should maybe notice this. Paul's wanting to go east, right? He's wanting to go east, but he's been told not to. So there is east. So instead of east going to him going east, east comes to him. Kind of interesting, you know. You want to figure out how to do this. The Lord knows how to do it better than we do. I don't know if you've noticed us in Vancouver, but the east has come to us. It's just the way it is, and God has His own ways of doing things. Okay, where do they go when they're in Philippi? Where do they first go in this scene? They go outside the gate to a place of prayer. So the first thing they do is they look for a place where they will do their prayers on Saturday or Friday night, and they go outside the gate. They go outside the gate, why? Because there's no synagogue in Philippi. You can't have it, you have to go where, so then what happens is in these small towns where there might be a few Jewish people, but not enough, you have to have 10 men. They go outside and they sit by a river. That's where you can do your ablutions properly. That's where you can do your washing ritually. So they're by the river, and I don't know about you, I just have a feeling, you know, they say, there's no men, right? It's only women. And it's a little bit tricky, you know, I mean, because you usually have to have men to have a synagogue. And so you've got women. Lydia is a representative of a manufacturer from the East, and I'm wearing purple today. So I noticed Lydia's wearing purple today. Thank you, Lydia. So she is a... Is this woman wealthy? How do you know that?
Purple is a very expensive color.
Okay, and? She invites them to what? To stay at her home. So she's going to cram another five people or so into her home. So she's got a big home. Now, I mean, there's just so many things about this thing. She is a listener. Do you notice that? She says she listens. She's thinking. She's a thinker. And she is already really interested in the God of the Jews. But now she really understands the keys to it is Jesus Christ. So then, her whole household is baptized. Now, I think they go through 6 months really usually checking to make sure these people should be baptized, right? Now, somehow it's a little quicker than that. They baptize her whole household. Now, I don't know who her household is, and there's lots of debate about this, but at least it's her servants, and perhaps her husband, and maybe her children. But anyway, you have a whole group of people baptized almost instantly. And then she invites us to her home. So you have this lovely little line. Her eyes are opened. She opens her home. That is actually very characteristic of becoming a Christian. You open yourself to Jesus, and He starts to open you to other people. And you open and become a hospitable person. Okay, and she then persuades us to stay. She's quite respectful, right, of Paul. She says, if you believe that I'm, you know, okay, I would be glad to have you at my home. There's a lot of respectfulness there. Okay, so they go to this home. Scene two, please.
Once, when we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune-telling. This girl followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so troubled that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her.
What strikes you in this scene? What's going on in this scene?
What she said.
Pardon?
What she said.
These men asked her. Yeah, what she says. She is the communications director for Paul these days. She's the media person. Of course, you do want to ask the question, why doesn't he stop her sooner? So, you have to think about that. I'm sure that his intention is not to talk to her first, but he's on the way somewhere to prayer, right? And then this lady starts screaming this stuff out. I don't know what you... It says that Paul is disturbed eventually. The term is actually grieved. So he is grieved about what's happening to her. But he hasn't acted right away. And he then drives the spirit out. I mean, I don't know about you, but if you were trying to do covert evangelism in a town that which you're not really, nobody knows you, I'm not sure if you'd be happy if the first person who sort of follows you around says, "These guys are telling you about God. You know, the Most High God." Could you do it a little quieter? I mean, you're obviously mentally disturbed. Why is it that the first person who is always around at the scene when Christians come is mentally disturbed? And it's sort of like it's not good for the system. You know, but who knows? I don't know. She is possessed, and Paul drives out the demon. Okay, so what else? What else happens in this scene? There's a power encounter, right? There's a power encounter between a Greek spirit of the python, the snake, who can tell the future and who can predict, and the Jewish God, who's represented by Paul and is in Jesus. Jesus has a power encounter with a Greek spirit, and it's Greek 0, Jesus 1 at the end of this one, right? Okay, next scene, please. Another way, just to say, if you're Paul, are you going to remember this? I mean, will you be telling this story 15 years later over a glass of wine, but a cup of coffee? Would he be actually remembering this? Of course he'd be remembering this. So scene 3, please.
Scene 3. When the owners of the slave girl realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Upon receiving such orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks.
So, what are the charges against Paul and Silas? And what are the real charges? What's the charge that they lay in front of the magistrates in the
market?
Unlawful customs, yes. They are doing something non-Roman, right? They're teaching things that are non-Roman. What else? These men are Jews. We've got anti-Semitic stuff going already, right? We've got people who are against the Jews. It's a racial profiling, right? Okay. And these people are all having their allegiance to Caesar, to Rome. And somebody non-Roman is teaching non-Roman customs and is going to infect all of us. We've got to get rid of this guy. Okay. But what's the real charge? The real charge is you guys are making us go broke, right? These people are teaching about God in such a way as it has economic implications for people. This woman is no longer useful to make money, and they're mad about it. So, like some presidents of countries, they take revenge on people who've affected them economically. Okay, so now let's just note that it's also a violent scene. What are the violent words that you see in this picture? As you read the passage, give me some of the violent words. Sorry? Seized. Grabbed them, yeah. Dragged, right? Stripped and beaten, right? Yes, severely flogged. Thrown into prison. And then guarded in the inner circle, in the inner cell. And they fastened their feet in stocks. So we have violence that's coming out here. And I hate to say it, but it's still going on, right? Just ask the Sri Lankans. I mean, may God comfort the church there and strengthen the people, because this has been going on for centuries, but there's a really violent reaction. Do you think Paul's going to remember this time? I think it would be in my memory bank forever. Yeah. So they begin to suffer, and there's anti-Jewish thinking. Okay, so now let's go to scene four.
Scene 4. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once, all the prison doors flew open and everybody's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself. We are all here."
Okay. Explain to me what Paul and Silas are doing and why they are doing it. They're praying, and as you pointed out to me, my friend, they may be going through some of the Psalms which say, "How long, O Lord, are you going to wait to come and deliver me?" I mean, it could be those kinds of prayers. It could be, "Help us, Lord, help us, Lord." You could be starting the prayers. I know we all imagine that they're all going to be honor and glory to the King and stuff like that, but maybe it start with, "Lord, would you please help us, guide us?" If I were Silas, I would have said, "Paul, are you sure it was a Macedonian that you said? Are you sure this was God that was calling us?" I mean, we all have doubts, right? Sometimes we say, you know, because it's not working out the way we thought. But anyway, they start to pray, and then they sing, because that's what happens in the Psalms. First it's, "Lord, help me," "Lord, deliver us," and then it's, "Lord, I trust you." And we start to sing our prayers. And of course, this is something they would do every day. They're just doing what good Jewish men do and Messianic Christians do. They sing to their Lord. Okay, so where are we here? A lot more comes on. So now we have a kind of a crucifixion scene, right? They are in the stocks. They can't move. They're chained, just like their Lord who was nailed to a tree. They've been flogged severely. I think it's a crucifixion scene, in a way. And then you have the resurrection scene, right? I mean, all of a sudden, boom! And how did we do this, Al? Faster, 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 faster. Come on, everybody. Boom, boom, get those guys loose. Yeah, okay, that's the point, isn't it? that all of a sudden you have a kind of a resurrection sense. Everything opens. The grave opens. It's an amazing thing. Do you think he's going to remember this incident? Yeah. So, next scene, please.
Scene 5. The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. At that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his family were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole family.
What do you see? What do you see? Sorry? The intervention of God. Yes. Very true. You see, do you know the term irony? Things are ironic. When things are ironic, they're the opposite of what you think is going to happen. The opposite happens. You expect this, like I go to the prayer meeting, and there's 50 women. That's a reversal, because you thought there would be 50 men if you're a man. Right? There's a reversal going on. Well, look at the reversal that goes on here. Now, I do think we should point out that in the crucifixion scene before, when they're in stocks and they're praying to God and singing, they also are feeling that they must care for the jailer. So that our Lord said on the cross, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Right. So there's a kind of forgiveness that they're feeling towards the jailer already in the last incident. That incident when they are freed, and they first of all say to the jailer, "You're safe. We're concerned for you. Don't kill yourself." So that's already happened. And the consequence of their action is what? What's the consequence of their concern for the jailer? The jailer says, he trembles. He comes before them. He gets the lights and he says, "Tell me how to be saved. You have been caring for me, and now I want to be saved. You have saved my life. I now want to save your life. I want to save my own life. I want to know that I can be saved. I want to know how this deliverance that we've been hearing about can happen." Okay. So then there's this very busy day, end of the day. The jailer opens his heart to Christ, asks how he can be saved. Paul and Silas tell him to put his trust in Jesus as Lord, not Caesar. His whole household will be saved. This thing about the household being saved, we got to meditate on that a bit. But maybe not today. But it's just like, that is always the longing of every parent, of every person who has other people in their house, the household. And somehow God knows that. And we all pray for our household. And we pray that God will save them all. They do a quick overview of the gospel of God's grace to the whole household. They are all baptized. Their sins are washed away. Then the jailer what? Washes the wounds of Paul. Is he Paul going to remember this? This is more like not bigger than washing feet. Somebody's washing wounds. And I'm sure Luke is sitting there saying, no, get that one. That's worse. I mean, he's the doctor, right? But they washed the wounds, and then they put on a table. "My heart is open. Now you, my, me casa, you casa. right? You come to my house. Everything I have, I will give to you. And then there's this joy. You know, I mean, what a day. At the end of this day, it says, there's joy breaking out in the house. He was filled with joy because he'd come to believe in God and his whole family. And this is about 2 a.m. God has declared there's an open house at the jail at 2 a.m. Just show up, then you'll be fine. There's even going to be food. It's quite something. You would remember this. Before dawn, you've gone through all these things. Now, scene 6.
Scene 6. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officers to the jailer with the order, "Release those men." The jailer told Paul, "The magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can leave. Go in peace." But Paul said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we are Roman citizens, and threw us into prison. And now do they want to get rid of us quietly? No! Let them come themselves and escort us out." The officers reported this to the magistrates, and when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. They came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city.
This is crazy. I mean, what's going on here? What's going on here? Yeah, they're Roman citizens. The magistrates say, you should go. You can go in peace, the warden says. And they say, "Give me a break." I mean, they say, "What? What does he think he's getting away with here?" He says, "We were seized, we were beaten, we were flogged. And now they just say, would you leave quietly, please?" No way. I mean, you think, what's wrong with Paul? He's stupid. He's made it. He's free. Why doesn't he just take off? Instead, he says, they've got to come and escort us. Now, you've got to realize that there was almost a riot in which a lot of people in Philippi would like to beat Paul up. So he's saying, bring your spears and your men and escort me in a parade out of the city so that everyone knows that nobody better lay a finger on me. And also, I would like you to know that I know who you are. I'm watching you. I know your names, and I'm going to be seeing Caesar sooner or later, and I might just tell him how it's going in Philippi. I mean, he is protecting the people who've just become Christians. He's saying, don't you lay a finger on them, because I know. I mean, I actually love this, that he cares enough for his new Christian friends, that he wants to lay down a rule of law, a kind of a parade which shows that they are protected in Philippi. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Paul, for that. Okay, so I think Paul's going to remember this. This is going to be something that would be really important to them. They were alarmed. So now instead of attacking, they appease. They escort. They request them to leave the city. It's really nice. Like, wouldn't you please go? You're going to get us into big trouble. It's a lot of irony. The judges decide to release Paul and Silas, only God's already done it. I mean, they're a little late. It's as if true forgiveness is found in the gospel, not in what the magistrates say. However, Paul makes this scene so that he can establish the legitimacy of the way of Christ for Roman citizens and calm things down for Philippi. Last scene.
Scene 7. After Paul and Silas came out of the prison, they went to Lydia's house, where they met with the brothers and sisters and encouraged them. Then they left.
How do you feel about the sins? What's it telling us? Pardon?
He's not in a hurry.
Yeah, there's no rush. There's no rush. I mean, I just love that calmness, right? And I want to go see my friends. There's affection to the friend. And I want them to know, I want them to open the door and see it's me. And everything's okay. I want, for their sake, for them to know that it's going to be all right. And a word of encouragement. Thank you. A word of encouragement. They don't take off right away. And they see that, and these people have been praying for them, I'm sure, so that they're seeing the answer to prayer. It starts at a prayer meeting. It ends with them going to a prayer meeting. So a few reflections. I know we're late here, but just a couple of things. Number one, do not despise the day of small beginnings, Zechariah 4. Do not despise just simple acts like a little trip across to Europe, you know, with a few people for what's going to happen in the future. Do the simple things. They go looking for a prayer meeting. They do that every week. They're just doing simple things. They worship with whoever turns up. They don't say, well, you're not quite my people. They just worship whoever's there. They are not worried about the fact that most of the people they influence are not very influential. I mean, their main audience is the prison. And, you know, a bunch of ex-cons is not necessarily the best way to influence the whole culture, but it could be. In fact, if we think about it, the church, the gospel of Christ was mostly transferred in what manner? Prisoners. It was really interesting, you know, you exiled the Jews to Babylon, and what happens? They start worshiping in Babylon, but they worship the Jewish God, and other people are influenced. Everywhere you go, prisoners take the gospel with them. So you just have to ask, who's linked to you as you're going along? And talk to them. Talk to them. Because that's what you can do. Simple thing. It's a small audience, but it's going to really be important. Paul and Silas are not under the circumstances. Do you know that term? How are you doing? Well, pretty well under the circumstances, you know. But actually, we are not under the circumstances. We are under Jesus, and he is the center of our life, not the circumstances. So small habits of loving God daily, of praying at night, of worship and prayers, this prepare you for the time when you will really need to do something better, bigger. But you do the small stuff first. The three people that are really mentioned, the slave girl, the Lydia, and the jailer, are all very different. They are so different. And this is the church. The church is different. People from all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of ethnicities. I am so glad that this church is still like that. It's a bit different. And I am thankful to the Lord for the unity that's demonstrated in the gospel as it is in the first church in Philippi. And lastly, God is the opener of eyes, hearts, prisons, homes, households. When God opens your heart, you open your heart to others. It's just the way it is. You find a way to be hospitable, and there's lots of ways to do it even if you don't have a home. You can take me out for lunch any day of the week. No wonder Paul says in Titus that a basic characteristic of a church leader is they are given to hospitality. You can't be a church leader if you're not given to hospitality. Why is that? Because Christianity is mostly discovered when you see how people live.
A lot of us can tell you how to become a Christian, but being one is a bit different. Being one long-term takes a lot of work and a lot of demonstration by somebody. So the Paul and Silas care for the jailer, and that makes the jailer come and ask for forgiveness and seek salvation. That is the way it's done. It's absolutely necessary in a hostile culture that somebody will take you in. Whether you're poor or rich, you will need help. So, when you open your home, God touches your household. Marilyn and I have to say how much we are grateful for all the ways people in this church and in our university group and in the camps have made a huge difference in the life of all our kids. We're really grateful. So this is the situation in the church in Philippi. And next week, Paul's going to write them 15 years later. I wonder what he will remember from his first time. And I wonder whether you will remember next week what was going on this week, because he's going to talk about his memories next week. Thanks be to God.